Continuing our study in the book of Job. And I wanted to give a recap from last week, and I hope you'll bear with me. It's a little bit lengthy of a recap, but we were diving into some pretty deep concepts. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about is how chapters 9 and 10 can be a little bit treacherous when we go to them without, I think, keeping in mind the context, both of what Job was trying to accomplish and how the events that were happening to Job might affect his thinking. You know, what are we to do with some of the things that Job says in chapters 9 and 10? We talked about how Job's thoughts here are going to be returning to Eliphaz's argument. So Bildad has just finished speaking in chapter 8. But Job is going to reference back to Eliphaz from Job chapter 4 and give some attention to some of the thoughts that Eliphaz originally presented. And similar to both Eliphaz and Bildad, Job spent some time talking about how much higher and more powerful God is than man. Like I said, you know, this can be a little treacherous if we don't, you know, if we aren't careful with the text. You know, it can lead to some wrong conclusions, I think, about who God is and the nature of our relationship with God if we just take what Job is saying at face value. So some of the contextual things we tried to talk about last week, we need to keep in mind that in this chapter, Job is giving a defense of his character against the accusations that his friends have raised against him. So it makes sense that the things he's saying in chapters 9 and 10 are going to serve that purpose. He's defending himself. Okay, we need to keep that in mind. If something that we're reading doesn't seem to fit well with some other scriptures, as we're trying our best to harmonize this with what the Bible teaches entirely, we have to remember that this isn't just Job offering random thoughts on the nature of God and morality and those types of things, but he's defending himself against his friends, okay? He's trying to prove that he's not the one to blame for what's happening, and that's where his mind is. So one of the things that we talked about is Job using the tactic as a defense of demonstrating that he understands what his friends are saying and where they're coming from. And I think if we've ever been accused of anything, we can relate to that. Maybe it's some tactic that we've employed as well. If someone says you're guilty of this and this and this, you can say, I can see what you mean, and I can see how if someone were doing the things that you're saying that would be the case, but here's why I'm not that. But in order to defend yourself against that, you need to demonstrate that you understand where they're coming from, that you're not just misunderstanding what they're saying. So I think that Job's using that tactic. We talked about that. You know, some examples we have are when Job asks rhetorically, who has hardened himself against God and succeeded? Like Job asks that rhetorically. Who has hardened himself against God and succeeded? Obviously, Job is not seeing himself as someone who has hardened himself against God. You know, this idea of hardening yourself against God, we were a few days ago in a Bible study with Kelly, and he had talked about in Jeremiah chapter 5, when God is rebuking Judah through Jeremiah, one of the things he says is they have made their faces harder than rock. They have refused to repent. So that's the idea behind this, who has hardened himself against God. And obviously, that's not the way Job sees himself. He's not trying to confront God. He's trying to fix the problem, and he's willing to change if someone would just show him what he did wrong. So he's contrasting himself there. And that's just one example. We looked at a few examples last week. And then again, keep in mind that it's possible that Job may not just be thinking clearly in everything he's saying. He's not had any sleep for who knows how many days. You know, he's gone into how, you know, at night he's terrified with visions and how, you know, in chapter 10 he's going to talk about how God brings fresh troops against him continually. And it's just this constant barrage of suffering he's going through. And we think about the effects that can have on someone's ability to think clearly. Not just the sleep and the suffering and all that. And we even have evidence that Job himself is aware of this. because he's referred to his own speech as the speech of a despairing man as wind. And he uses that to indict his friends to say, you know, you're so caught up in trying to win an argument that you would even debate a person who's not even making a whole lot of sense, who's just suffering and who just wants comfort. And so we get that. Job has some self-awareness there. Okay, so keep that in mind too. In verse 13, we talked about how it says, God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. We talked about how the ESV translates Rahab as a proper name, which I struggle making sense out of. But other translations actually translate the word Rahab from Hebrew to English and use it to modify the word helpers, which makes a lot more sense. So the idea would be these proud, mighty helpers even bow to God, meaning that who can Job turn to? Even the most mighty of helpers at the end of the day are going to bow to God. And then we work through verses 14 through 21. And we talked about how in verse 15, where it says, Job says, though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. And then in verse 20, he says, though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. So basically, Job is talking about how even though he is in the right and he believes he's blameless, he's still basically wrong. And he has to appeal to God's mercy. So how does that even make sense? Well, I think what Job's doing here is he's giving his perspective on the nature of right and wrong. What does it mean to be right? What does it mean to be wrong? And when Job says that he may be right, he's saying that he's right by some objective standard of right and wrong. Okay? He's blameless by that standard. He's done nothing wrong to that standard, whatever it may be. And the implication is that Job has his own view of right and wrong, and God has God's own view of right and wrong. And right now, those things don't match. And that is a problem for Job. And he's arguing that even if he believes his understanding of right and wrong is more accurate than God's, what can he do? How is he going to hold God accountable or change God's mind if God's got his mind made up? Because at the end of the day, what God says is going to be what goes. No one's more powerful than God to hold him accountable to anything like that. This is how Job's reasoning through it, okay? Yeah, Kelly? Job seems like he's confident in what God thinks about some of these things. He's confident that God has decided that he's going to suffer and that he's not going to change his mind about it. And he's going to appeal to him in chapter 10, and you're going to see this again a couple of times as we go. And I think that it's not just for the sake of doing it. I think Job does hope to change God's mind, but I think that he's saying that God's not obligated to change based on how I understand right and wrong to be, because who am I compared to God? I don't think I did anything wrong. I think I'm blameless, but that's not what God thinks. That's what he thinks. He thinks that's not what God thinks. Of course, there's another layer here. We know what's going on behind the scenes, and we know that God doesn't think that he's guilty of anything. So we know Job is a little bit off in this. And what he's doing is he's following this line of deductive reasoning to reach some conclusions in this chapter that we need to be careful we understand them in their proper context. Yeah, Sean?
I'm just wondering about in Romans 9:20, whenever it talks about how God used Pharaoh and Moses, and it talks about, you know, like who will the clay say, right? So, like, who made this way? What are you doing? And I, you know, that concept of if Job was just kind of going through this, that this is kind of how I'm seeing in the reality, there's actually some truth behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think that One of the things I struggle with too, working through when Job talks through these things, is I kind of feel like he's simultaneously trying to convince his friends he's not guilty while still wrestling with these things himself on his own. Because it's hard to reconcile his previous experience with God with what's happening to him now. And it would be hard for any of us, for sure. So he's going down this line of deductive reasoning. And just a moment to explain, if you're not familiar with that term, of deductive reasoning. It's a type of reasoning that basically goes like this. It says, if A is true, and if B equals A, then B is also true. So in other words, the truth of B depends on the truth of A. Okay, A has to be true in order for B to be true. So you establish something, and then you take the next step, and you establish that, and you take the next step, and you establish that, and you work your way towards a conclusion. That's deductive reasoning, and that's what Job's doing here. It's been formalized in logic and philosophy for thousands of years, literally. It's a tried and true method, but it's not perfect because it's only as good as the assumptions upon which it's founded. And in this case, we know from the outset that some of the assumptions Job has are not right. He thinks God believes he's guilty of something. Okay, so this is a little bit treacherous for him now to start going down this line of reasoning, and we're going to see some of the problematic conclusions that it leads him to. So Job is reasoning, if no one is more powerful than God, which is an assumption he sets up in verses 12 and 13. We talked about that when he says, behold, he snatches away in verse 12. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, what are you doing? In other words, God can take what he wants to take. He can do what he wants to do. And who's going to change his mind? This idea of saying, what are you doing, carries with it the idea of trying to get someone to repent or turn from what they're currently doing. Like, wake up, what are you doing? That's kind of the idea behind it. So if no one is more powerful than God, then no one can challenge God's judgments on what's right and wrong. And then you can go down to verses 32 and 33, where Job kind of explores that idea. In verse 32, he says, for he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. So if there's no one more powerful than God, then no one can challenge God's judgments on what's right and wrong. There's no other judge that Job can appeal to that's going to say, okay, God, you take this side, Job, you take this side, and we're going to sort this thing out. There's no one in that position of authority because the authority ends with God. That's the problem that Job's having. So no one's able to challenge God's judgments on what's right and wrong. So for all practical purposes then, God's power and his authority basically renders any objective standards of right and wrong irrelevant. Because if no one can challenge God's judgments on right and wrong, then that's what goes. And that's kind of where Job is in his thinking. Regardless of whether it's right by some other standard, if that's what God thinks is right, then that's going to be what happens. This is how Job's reasoning through it. And again, that's unfortunate for someone who doesn't happen to agree with God on something or who finds himself on the other end of something. In Job's case, he's suffering because of it. And what's even more troubling to someone like Job then is the implication that such a God could suddenly change his opinion of what's right and wrong. And who's going to hold him accountable for doing that? Logical, right? A to B to C to D. We're just going down the logical path. And this is where Job is going. And I think that you have this idea again presented. We talked about verse 12, how he snatches away. He takes what he wants. He does what he wants, even if it may be to the harm of others. And, you can't cause him to repent. No one can do that because he's higher than they are. Even the mightiest of helpers bow to him. In verse 13, he says, God will not turn back. He won't turn back his fierce anger. And in verse 17, you have a little bit more evidence of this. When he says, he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. Well, how could it be without cause unless it's by some other standard of right and wrong that Job's still appealing to? Job doesn't agree with God on how he's interpreting that standard of right and wrong. Okay? So Now let's get into verse 22, and this is kind of where we left off. I told you that was a long recap. verse 22, and we're gonna keep going down that logical path and see the problematic theology it leads us to. And then we're going to try to reset and say, is this truly the God that we serve? That's an important question for us coming out of this. So verses 22 through 24, Job says, "It is all one, therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it?" So that's a problem. That's a problem. What Job is saying right there is a problem. He's saying that no one's more powerful than God, so therefore whatever God says goes, regardless of whether or not it's right, quote unquote. And if whatever he says goes, he can change his mind as he pleases, because there's no one who's going to tell him he can't do that. He's more powerful than they are. He has more authority than they do. And if God can change his mind as he pleases, then we arrive where Job's at now. There's no difference between the innocent and the wicked. Yeah, Kelly? Yeah. And he believes that not because he's reasoned to that on his own, but because that's the reality he's living in. He knows he hasn't done anything wrong, yet here he is. So it's leading him to this conclusion. So we have talked in the past a little bit about, like, you know, is Job saying the right things? And I think this is some of the stuff that we need to be like, no, no, he's not. There's a need for this to get cleaned up a little bit, because this isn't the God that we serve. We don't serve a God who indiscriminately destroys both the innocent and the wicked. That's not the God we serve. And we also need to talk about, for just a moment, again, as we think about how Job might be wrestling with these things himself, Job himself still holds to the idea that the wicked deserve to be punished, but the innocent don't. He sees a difference between the two, right? So he's not saying there is no difference. He's saying God sees no difference in this. So again, you have that separation between what Job thinks is right and what God thinks is right, as Job's reasoning through this. Okay, if Job actually himself saw no difference between the wicked and the innocent, then this whole case is pointless. Like, why is he even talking right now? You know, but he's trying to establish that he's innocent, and that means something. That means something in how he's answering his friends. It's important for him to establish his innocence. Okay, so he's saying that God is dealing with the innocent and the wicked as he pleases. And again, who's powerful enough or wise enough to make God change his mind? And he closes in verse 24 by saying, if it's not God, then who is it? Show me someone who's more powerful or capable who's causing these things to happen, because to me it ends with God. There's no one more powerful than him. So this is where I want to step back for a minute, and I want to kind of look at this from our own perspective and talk a little about some of the things that Job is ascribing to God that I don't believe are correct before we get back into the narrative. So, you know, bear with me. But I think that the idea of God affecting the outcome of a matter because of his great power, and even perhaps unjustly, that he's causing things to happen and it isn't really fair for someone like Job, I think that's actually a recurring theme we see throughout the book of Job. Job's obviously hitting it very heavily right now in chapter 9. And both of Job's friends so far have argued along these lines too. Although they're not insinuating God is unjust, they do talk a lot about how much higher and more powerful God is than man. That's kind of the main point they're making, and in different respects. You know, Eliphaz, God is morally superior, and Bildad, God endures and man does not endure. Well, what's interesting is that this theme, I think, is also present if you go back to chapters 1 and 2 in the throne room, when you have the Satan approaching God and challenging him, because the Satan is accusing God of placing a hedge around Job. So in other words, the Satan is arguing that, you know, God, you have enabled Job to be your disciple because you've protected him. You have demonstrated your power in such a way that prevents anything bad from happening to Job, and that's why Job serves you. And you know what? If you withhold your power of protection from him and you let evil things attack him, he'll curse you to your face. In essence, remove the element of your power, and what have you got left? That's the challenge he's bringing before God. Remove your power from this situation. Let Job be attacked, and let's see what happens. Let's see what he's really made of. Okay, so the protection is a demonstration of God's power. And that Satan is saying, you're not allowing anything bad to happen to him. So if we're following this line of reasoning that I think Job's demonstrating now, and that the Satan seemed to demonstrate back in chapters 1 and 2, essentially we're arriving at the old adage of might makes right. Whoever is the most powerful, whoever is the highest in authority, decides what goes. And they decide what goes because who's more powerful than them? Whether it's right or wrong, because they have so much power, they can affect whatever outcome they want. That's the adage we've arrived at. And I want to talk about that some more. But yeah, go ahead, Kelly. Yes. Yes, and that's exactly where I want to go. One of my big picture takeaways from the book of Job, if I step back and just look at it, is I think these events are happening, or there's something happening as these events unfold that's intended to prove to us, to the readers of this, who have it so many years after it was written, that yeah, God is powerful, but he's not only powerful, he's good. He's intrinsically good. And I think that you can see this when we get to the end of the book and God's response to Job, when God recounts all the mighty, powerful works that he's done. But all those things are also focused on how his power is providing for his creation. That it's not just power laying down a law, but that he's protecting and providing for those who can't protect or provide for themselves. Even to some of these obscure animals that he's going to get into. He's watching out for them. And I think the idea is that God's power serves God's love. As Kelly's point, Kelly was making the point. I would argue God is not in charge because he is all powerful, but he's all powerful because he's intrinsically good. His power serves his goodness. And you think about some of the other terms the Bible uses to describe God's core nature, right? You think about, I think about 1 John a lot. I think about how it describes God as God is light. God is light. It's not a metaphor. It's not, you couldn't drop the word like in there and not change the meaning of that passage. It's not that God is like light in some ways. It's that God intrinsically is light in the sense that he is pure. He's good. God is love. That's a big one. It doesn't say that God loves much, although he does, but intrinsic to God's nature is love. God is love. And there are verses that, of course, talk about his power, but I don't know of any verses that say God is power or God is might in the same way as it says God is light and God is love. So, yes, he's all powerful. Yes, he is mighty. But those, his power serves his core attributes of goodness and love. And those are the attributes that are going to motivate the decisions he makes. And we've seen that play out through history. Did God sacrifice his son because he wasn't powerful enough to bring people to heaven? He did it as a demonstration of love. Like, there's more to this than just God is the most powerful being, so we should follow him. There's a lot more depth to it than that. And I think that depth can get overlooked if we're just following the line of reasoning where Job is unfortunately on right now. And he's going to come around. And where the Satan was. Yeah, Kelly.
I was going to ask, do you think Job had a
I have to think that his suffering affected how he viewed God's nature. I think he thought God was a certain way, and through his intense suffering, he's like, well, now I've got all this other evidence, and what do I do with it? So let's go back to Job specifically, okay? Yeah, God temporarily removed his provision over Job, and he allowed the Satan to basically just ransack him. But we have the bigger picture. We have the benefit of the bigger picture, and let's not lose sight of that, okay? We understand that that suffering was going to be temporary. We understand that God is going to restore Job because he loves Job. And I think actually you can make a case that it's actually important for Job to kind of stumble a little bit throughout this process. So that way when God restores him, it's not because of Job's righteousness. You know, there's an element of graciousness in God's restoration of him. It's not just because now Job's getting what he deserves. You know, he doesn't handle this perfectly. But the trust that Job has in God, I really bungled that. The trust that Job has in God is going to be strengthened through weakness. And that's, again, a theme that we see throughout the scriptures as well. How our trust in God is strengthened through weakness. How our relationship with him is deepened through moments of weakness. You know, I think about, you know, Paul when he wrote in 2 Corinthians 4:17 about this momentary light affliction. And Paul suffered a lot. He refers to his momentary light affliction and how it prepares us for a weight of glory beyond all comparison. So anyway, just the idea of going through a trial, you know, we need to try our best to think about how our relationship with God can grow closer through that weakness. And, you know, through the weakness, our dependence on him and how he provides for us, is those become more obvious when we're really being put through it. But, you know, where we're at in this book, and Job isn't quite there yet. He's working through these things. I hope that mostly makes sense. Yeah, Britt?
Quick question. I think one of the reasons why we try to give a lot of our perspective onto Job is because we have the New Testament. We need to remember that Job had none of that.
Right.
So he didn't have the examples that we have. So Job is actually drawing what we would consider logical conclusions from the Old Law and from the Old Testament. And from everything we see in the Old Testament, that would be true. They're completely wrong, but that's where he's getting his basis from. We can look at that with a completely different perspective. So when you say big picture, we don't want to look at Job.
Right.
We also have the entire New Testament.
Right.
We know what the motivation is. We know that. And God is trying to show that to Job. And that's so contrary. I mean, the Jews struggled with it for hundreds of years and still struggle with it today. So it's not uncommon. It shouldn't be, we shouldn't be looking at Job and saying, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Actually, he does.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have the same experience base that we would.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that, did Job have enough information as was asked earlier? Did he have that information about God before? Probably not.
Yeah.
Does he have a better understanding of it now after the fact of all this? Probably. But surely not as well as ours is, because lots more data, lots more information.
Right. Yeah, he obviously didn't have the New Testament. Poor guy didn't even have chapters 1 and 2 of his own book. You know, poor guy. So obviously he lacked that context. And I think that, yes, we can relate to Job in some ways in that, in a vacuum, as we like to say, his logic's pretty sound. But deductive reasoning is only as sound as the assumptions upon which it's founded. And Job's assumptions were faulty. And it was because of a lack of knowledge. But let's be careful in our own reasoning, right? Let's not presume to know things perfectly because we may be missing a part of the picture. Yeah.
Even in heaven,
any of that is correct. And it also tells you that even in heaven, if the limited information we have about, say, I tend to think it's say, what the accuser, you know what I mean? But either way, that there was something in that heavenly realm that he got cross about. And so it's not, it doesn't mean that God isn't good, but apparently everyone kind of struggles with this, no matter where you're at. Which is, I don't know what to do with that, but it's just kind of, in an odd way, kind of encouraging. Like, you're not going crazy, but you do need to be reminded.
Yeah, no, good thoughts. Yeah, Billy?
Well, we've also got to be careful. You know, sometimes we get into debates about topics.
Yeah.
And issues, and there's a couple of ways you could go, and then we start getting into a theoretical religious conversation, and we lose sight of who God is. And
amen to that.
We're sometimes afraid somebody maybe backs us into a corner and says, well, then you've got God doing this. And we know, yeah, that's pretty mean, and God isn't like that, but I'm not going to lose this argument. So I'm going to stick to this, even if it turns God into a monster. I guess I'm having a hard time thinking of a specific example, but we've all been in situations where we have to decide on a topic what is probably the correct way to go there. And sometimes the answer would be, if we remember that God is loving us, that God is kind to us, and it feels like sometimes we want to go the other way. I'm pretty sure God's going to come down on me on this one, and so I'm going to go this direction on this issue, when in reality, the whole text that we do have, the whole revelation that we have, is showing over and over again that God is kind and patient. And even with Job here, he does chastise Job eventually, but he doesn't stop loving Job. He doesn't disregard Job.
And that's evident in the outcome, right? That's evident in him restoring Job and Job finding comfort.
Yeah, so I mean, we need to keep at the forefront of everything, everything that we're reasoning through, who God is, who he has shown himself to be over the millennia, who he has revealed himself to be, and how kind and good he is. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean he doesn't expect us to obey him. But,
right.
But we need to keep both of those things in mind, that he is patient and kind and merciful, and he has expectations for us. And then that can better inform how we make our decisions and how we live.
Right.
As opposed to this attitude, which is, well, God is God, so who knows what he's going to do to you.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I think that maybe to your point, the book of Job for me has had a lot of practical, personal application in how I approach disagreements with other brothers, and more so than it has in the past, the more I read it. We just have to be careful about following a line of reasoning and just assuming that some of these foundations behind our reasoning are solid, or just entertaining that, okay, let's assume it's solid for a moment and see where this goes. Let's just be careful. And let's keep in mind, I think, to the points that are being made, the totality of who God is and what attributes define him to the core. Okay, what defines God to the core are things like light and love. And yes, justice is there, because he has to be just, or what is, he can't be light, he can't be pure if he isn't just, right? So there's other things that can kind of that spin off of those core attributes. But, you know, I've seen an atheist cartoon of God sitting on his throne and someone going before him and saying, but I trusted in Jesus. And God says, why would I sacrifice my own son just to save everybody? That's absurd. Here he is sitting and all-powerful on his throne. Why would I have to kill my own son to get this job done? And that's an atheistic criticism of Christianity. And that's along these same lines that we're talking about here. If God's all powerful, then just do what you want, God. Who's going to stop you? If you want me to be saved, save me. If not, why did you create me? And unfortunately, that's kind of where Job is going next. He's going to ask God, why did you create me just so I would suffer? That doesn't make sense. You made me. Why? For this purpose. Yeah, Kelly? Yeah.
The God we serve is completely the opposite of that.
Yeah.
And that ought to give us all of help strengthen our faith. But no, our God is not like the God that you create, because he actually is a God that sent his son to die because he loves us. That's very different from the gods of the ancient world.
Well, and it's very different than some religions even today. I mean, to the religion of Islam, the idea that God would sacrifice his son to save us is blasphemy. Why would an all-powerful God do that to himself? Why would you ascribe that to God? Who are you? You tell him he would sacrifice his son for you? That doesn't make any sense. So there are religions even today that hold to that as well. Okay, didn't want to belabor the point, but we did spend a lot of time on that. Just a couple of minutes, let's finish chapter 9, and then, Lord willing, next week we'll get into chapter 10. Verses 25 and 26 in Job chapter 9, Job says, "My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey." And again, Job saying that he's recognizing that his chances of seeing good in this life are slipping away from him quickly. And in verse 27, he continues, says, "If I say, I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and be of good cheer." In other words, just will himself to try to have a positive attitude. "Then I become afraid of all of my suffering, for I know you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me." So there's several things in here. One of the things I wanted to point out is this idea that Job says, if he does these things, then he will be condemned. I think you could use as evidence, if you wanted to talk about, did Job believe in an afterlife? Because that is a discussion we've had as well. Yes, I think that he's saying that he believes there's condemnation following even what he's going through now. And I think that it concerns him. And in verse 31, you know, it talks about being plunged into a pit. So this idea of a pit, this image is very consistent with Jewish thoughts on the afterlife. You know, you can read other, even like non-biblical Jewish literature, and you see that image is used to represent kind of this punishment after life is over. You know, I think it's in the Book of Enoch, where it, you know, exploring some of the ancient Jewish thoughts on the afterlife, this idea of these great stone structures that have hollowed out areas in the stone where people are kept reserved for judgment. And you think about the unpleasantness of basically just being stuck in a dark hole waiting for judgment. So when you see that idea of pit, that's pretty consistent across ancient Jewish literature as representing kind of like, you know, suffering after death. And again, you know, I think that you know, Job throughout this, he's trying to show that he's innocent. But the thought of that, it's terrifying to Job, even in view of his current suffering. So then, verses 32 and 33, we talked about, "He's not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both." Verse 34, "Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself." So I think there's a couple of ways that verses 34 and 35 could be understood. It could be Job saying that he just wants to talk to God, but so in such a way that he's not scared to death to do it. Like, let me talk to you without this whole fear thing affecting me. And that way we can have a reasoned conversation together. But another way to read this, again, in light of Job, again, defending his innocence to his friends, would be that he's showing that he hasn't hardened himself against God. He is indeed terrified of God. Okay, it's more evidence that he's not this person who's made his face hard like flint. He's terrified of the thought of seeing God face to face. Okay, so thank you. We're out of time. Next week we will start in chapter 10 and we'll keep going from there. Thank you so much for your comments and questions.